Case number 13-5202. Matt Sissel, appellant versus United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. Mr. Sandifer for the appellant, Ms. Klein for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The bill that originated in the House of Representatives was not a bill for raising revenue. Any suggestion that it was in our brief was an error. We agree entirely with the amici. The original House bill was not a bill for raising revenue and did not increase taxes.
It did not increase taxes?
No, Your Honor.
I thought you acknowledged it raised corporate taxes.
In some unguarded language, we made that suggestion. In fact, what that bill...
That was a fact, wasn't it? I mean, it's not a question of what you said in your brief. It did raise corporate taxes.
If simply examining the bill, what the bill did was three things. It provided a tax credit for veterans buying their first homes. It increased the interest rate that had to be paid by corporations paying their taxes on the installment plan. That was something that was a little bit confusing. But
would a corporation think that's an increase in taxes?
No, Your Honor, because it doesn't increase the overall...
Because that's a withholding?
It doesn't increase the overall tax liability of the corporation.
All right.
It increases just how much they have to pay if they're paying on a payment plan. Then the third thing that it did was it increased slightly the penalty for failing to pay your taxes, which I don't think anybody would contend is a tax increase. So, no, the original House bill was not a bill for raising revenue and did not levy any taxes. The Senate then transformed that bill into a bill for raising revenue, which the Senate originated in violation of the Constitution. Now, the district court dismissed this case on the grounds that the Affordable Care Act itself is not a bill for raising revenue.
Before you get into the merits, Mr. Sandifer, we do have an obligation to assure ourselves that there's a justiciable controversy here. That given the time that's passed since the complaint was filed, do we know more about the status of Mr. Sissel in terms of whether he has enough income to qualify to have to pay his shared responsibility payment? Do we know anything?
There's been no permanent change in that regard. There is a temporary change.
Has he not filed a tax form yet?
I'm unaware of whether he has done that or not, Your Honor, but he has not purchased health insurance. However, the reason he's not present today is he volunteered to join his National Guard unit to assist in recovery in the Philippines for the recent hurricane there. And while he's on duty, he will have insurance. But that duty that insurance will then no longer be provided once he's no longer on that duty. And so we don't think that that affects his standing in any way. The same thing happened in the district court. We notified the court of that, and the court found no concern with regard to standing.
I know, but we have an independent obligation to satisfy ourselves that they're standing. This is a pre-enforcement challenge, what's the harm or what's the imminent harm to him?
The reason it doesn't affect his standing, however, is because he will be required to comply with the statute. Even if he temporarily is having this bill paid, he will be required to pay it. And if he does not, he will be required to pay the tax for failing to obtain health insurance. So that inevitability is the same kind of inevitability that was at issue in the original Florida case that turned into NFIB versus Sebelius. In that case, it was a pre-enforcement action, and there was a question about, well, these people might buy health insurance between now and the decision, and the court found no obstacle to standing.
Well, in our court, in Seventh Sky versus Holder, the court allowed a pre-enforcement challenge to the mandate, but withheld judgment on whether such a challenge would be justiciable with respect to the tax. And if we believe that all we have before us today is the tax, then we have that question now that our court has expressed this that is unresolved about justiciability.
To determine standing, I think in this case is a rather simple matter. Standing simply requires the demonstration of, in this case, an imminent injury to the plaintiff, which is fairly traceable to the defendant's conduct, which can be resolved by the court. And Mr. Sisso will be required to purchase health insurance or to pay the tax. That is not an accidental or happenstance circumstance. It is a permanent and definite circumstance.
I'm just saying we don't know enough from the complaint. Isn't it your burden to plead facts that show us that he's not going to be getting Medicare, that he's not within any income exemption, that he's earning enough, that he's, you know, not otherwise employed, he said he wanted to go to school? Don't we need to know that he's not in school receiving or required to get insurance because of that?
No, Your Honor. We are not required to disprove the potential happenstances of life in order to demonstrate.
But tell us what's happening now. It's been a couple of years.
What's happening now is that Mr. Sisso has not purchased health insurance, and he's temporarily on the insurance for his unit, but he has not and will not purchase the health insurance as alleged in the complaint. There has been no change, of which I'm aware, in his status.
And you don't know whether he's filed his tax form.
I have not spoken to him on that issue. And like I said, he's out of the country, and it did not occur to me to ask him that question. But I can certainly follow up with a supplemental pleading on that issue. Mr. Sissel, if he had paid the taxes, that itself would be an injury because he would then have paid an unconstitutional
That's
tax.
That's the reason I'm interested.
Yes. Well, and we would be happy to supplement on that issue. That was not pled in any of the briefs, so I apologize for not being fully prepared with cases on the issue.
Do you want to submit a letter by the end of the week?
We certainly could do that, Your Honor, no question. With regard to the dismissal, the reason for the dismissal by the district court was that the ACA itself is not a bill for raising revenue, and it based that determination on a vague inquiry into legislative motive, which is not appropriate and really not manageable, and it has never been the test that has been used. Now, granted, there are a few precedents in this area, but those precedents show that the determination of whether a bill qualifies as a bill for raising revenue is whether or not it, quote, is a statute that raises revenue to support the government generally, end quote. That's from Munoz-Flores. And Munoz-Flores, the Supreme Court, distinguished two kinds of bills that increase funds to the government and said those that raise money for a particular government program and supports only that program are not bills for raising revenue. So, for example,
didn't our court say that the purpose of the mandate and the tax was not to raise revenue? Wasn't that part of the ruling in Seven Sky?
The problem with that ruling, Your Honor, is that determining that the tax has the purpose of getting people to buy insurance is an inquiry into the kind of legislative motive that courts have tended not to apply, and because it would be too easy to evade such an inquiry into what was the general purpose of requiring people to pay this stuff.
Well, in Norton and Nebaker, they looked at purpose, right?
In what happened in Nebaker, it's true that the word purpose occurs in Nebaker, but what Munoz-Flores makes clear is that both in Nebaker and in the railroad case, Miller versus Roberts, in those cases what happened was that the government created a specific program and simply raised funds for that program.
But the point is, the Supreme Court keeps looking at what is the purpose of the legislation.
With respect, Your Honor, I think that's not correct. I think what's happened...
Well, I mean, they keep using that phrase, right?
It is true that they describe a statute and say, well, the purpose of the statute is such and such. But then they say, but it's not a tax because it raises money for a particular program. Got identifiable beneficiaries, or
it's not a bill for raising revenue.
That's
because it identifies a program.
It identifies
and
a program.
It earmarks the funds.
That's
but
right.
But the court keeps going through that analysis to which Judge Wilkins has referred.
Well, I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that a good example would be the Beef What's for Dinner ads, right?
When you say courts do not do this, you're not including the Supreme Court.
No, what I'm saying is that an inquiry into the general overarching purpose of a statute, as the government is trying to argue is the test, is not the test and is not what courts have done.
The Supreme Court's statement in the NFIB case?
I don't believe that the Supreme Court addressed this question in NFIB. It's
as
true.
As to what was the purpose of the legislation?
Oh, yes. Well, again, that was not an inquiry into the legislative purpose in the vague sense in which I'm discussing. What I'm saying is, the court said, yes, the purpose of the tax is to have people sign up for insurance. It did not go on to say, therefore, it's not a bill for raising revenue. It went on to address the questions that were presented in that case. In other cases in which the question has been, what is a bill for raising revenue, the court has determined whether it is a bill for raising revenue or not, not on the basis of what Congress had in mind when they passed the bill, but on the question of whether this statute creates a particular program and earmarks those funds for that program.
So this is your argument that there are only two exceptions to the origination clause requirement.
What
we're addressing is the fact that this case hasn't been yet decided by the Supreme Court.
That's correct. This question has not been decided.
It's never said that there are only two exceptions where you have a bill that involves taxes.
Munoz-Flores says that a revenue-raising measure is not a bill for raising revenue if it creates a particular government program and funds that program. That's true. And there are other cases in which the court has said that penalties like fines are not bills for raising revenue. Those are the only two exceptions that appear in the case law.
Can I ask you this? Is Hubbard the only case where a court has struck down a law for violating the origination clause?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the only case we are aware of.
And you didn't cite Hubbard either in your opening or your reply briefs?
I think we cited it once in one of the briefs, but we don't rely on it much. It's a district court case.
It's not in your table of authorities in either brief.
Okay. In any event, it's not very helpful in this case because it's very different from what occurred here.
So the only case that's ever done it is not very helpful.
That's correct, Your Honor. What happened here is unprecedented and unique. The origination clause cases are very rare, and those cases that have come along have said a bill that raises revenue generally for the government to spend at the legislature's discretion is a bill for raising revenue, whereas a fine or a particular program is not. And that any Senate amendments that occur to a House-generated measure must be germane. Now, it's true, those are old cases, and there are not many of them. But
Hubbard
also
said that to determine whether the bill started in the House or the Senate, you look basically at the records of the Secretary of the House, Secretary of the Senate, et cetera. All of those records in this case would say that this bill at issue originated in the House, right?
That's correct.
So if we use the same analysis as in Hubbard, you would lose.
That's incorrect, because Hubbard preceded Munoz-Flores. In Munoz-Flores, the Supreme Court explicitly rejects reliance on the enrolled bill rule approach that was used in that case and that was advanced by the dissenters in Munoz-Flores. In footnote 4 of Munoz-Flores, the court says it is not up for Congress to determine whether a bill originated in the House for origination clause purposes, since the origination clause is a constitutional restriction on Congress's authority to determine its own rules. That's why Rainey is also inapplicable. Rainey is the case in which the government puts most of its emphasis. And Rainey, again, although I think it's debatable whether Rainey actually stands for what they say it does, Rainey says, well, we're not going to determine whether the Senate amendment was a valid amendment or not, because at that time the court was employing the enrolled bill rule approach that it explicitly rejects in Munoz-Flores. Munoz-Flores tells us that origination clause challenges are justiciable. If they are justiciable, then there must be legal differences between origination and amendment. There just must be. And the basic difference would be germaneness. Germaneness is the only difference between origination and amendment, just speaking logically anyway. Without germaneness, all amendments would be origination.
Right. Well, you've given us a definition of germaneness from, I guess, the House rules. The Senate rules, is my reading of these briefs, there's no definition of germaneness from the Senate rules, other than, I guess, there's something Thomas Jefferson wrote a long time ago that you or amici dispute. How is it justiciable for us to figure out what germaneness is if there's no precedent from the body that in the first place that would decide this issue, i.e. one of the two chambers, doesn't give us any real guidance?
I would contend that the Senate's view of germaneness is actually not very enlightening, because the Senate can be expected to write its rules in a way that maximizes its power at the expense of House prerogatives. And here we're talking about a House prerogative. So the Senate's view on what the House can do is probably not very enlightening.
Let me ask you this. I looked at the congressional record, the House debate, after the bill came from the Senate into the House, to see if any House member made an objection because the Senate amendment was not germane. I didn't see that anywhere.
We would contend that that's irrelevant, Your Honor, as explicitly declared by Munoz-Flores. Munoz-Flores says the mere fact...
So it doesn't matter at all that it didn't occur to any House member to raise an objection that the amendment wasn't germane?
That's correct. Munoz-Flores takes precisely that line.
Is it relevant at all that we have a brief from members of the House saying nobody thought this was a revenue bill?
The House members who contend that this bill violates the origination clause, I think, yes, they shine light on this case. And certainly the fact that a bill, whether House members get up and object or not, might shine some light on the case, but it doesn't.
No, brief states no one viewed this as a bill to raise revenues. Is that relevant at all? And the court can take that into account?
No, Your Honor. The Munoz-Flores.
No. Right.
I'm not saying that the court can't take it into
account. What the Constitutional Convention tells us about what they thought the origination clause meant?
If I can go back and answer your first question, the
you
position
did. You said no.
The position of the House on whether a bill is satisfies the origination clause or not might be enlightening to some degree, but Munoz-Flores says it is not determinative. In fact, that was the argument that was advanced by the dissenters in that case, and the court rejected it. As far as the Philadelphia Convention is less enlightening than the ratification conventions. At the ratification conventions, there was only a single instance in which somebody objected, well, wait a minute, the Senate's power to amend would override the origination clause because the Senate could go back and amend by striking out and replacing. And James Madison got up and said, no, that is not the case. That is not what the clause will mean. And it was on the basis of that reassurance that the Constitution was ratified. Nobody spoke up to disagree with Mr. Madison on that point, and his position is rather clear. Is there any further questions?
Thank you. No.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government. Good morning.
Elisa Klein for the United States. Let's start with the way the House would have perceived the amendments that the Senate made to the House-originated bill in this case. The House-originated bill was exclusively amendments to the Internal Revenue Code. Some of them were tax credits. Other measures were tax increases in estimated corporate taxes, and increases in run-of-the-mill tax penalties for failure to file an income tax. Under 200 years of House precedent, that's a revenue bill. So for the House, they don't need to look at each of the hundreds of provisions of the Affordable Care Act and ask the question, what was the purpose? Is it a revenue measure? The House, was established by the Supreme Court in Rainey that the Senate can amend a House-originated revenue bill to the same extent that it can amend all other bills. This is the second half of the origination clause, the text of the origination clause. The Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. Their Constitution does not and has never placed any germaneness constraint on Senate amendments of any other bills. This is the point Thomas Jefferson made in the very first manual of parliamentary procedure that we submitted to the court. And therefore, when it came to the Supreme Court in Rainey, and this is dispositive here, you had a challenge, as here, to a Senate amendment to a House-originated revenue bill. And the Supreme Court first did say, without intimating that this is even justiciable, but then went on to say, assuming that we explicitly adopt the reasoning of the trial court, this is the entire reasoning, I'm satisfied that the section in question is not void as a bill for raising revenue originating in the Senate and not in the House of Representatives. It appears that the section, this is the challenged amendment, was proposed by the Senate as an amendment to a bill for raising revenue which originated in the House. That is sufficient. Having become an enrolled and duly authenticated act of Congress, it is not for the court to determine whether the amendment was or was not outside the purposes of the original bill. And this is not a justiciability holding.
Could I just ask you, you said 200 years of House practice? H.R. 3590 was a revenue bill?
Yes.
And how do we know that?
If you look, the House takes a quite broad view of revenue bills, but even under the narrower view that we can assume, you know, proposed by the plaintiffs on page 11 of its reply, since revenues generated from the tax are for general revenues and not for a particular program, the tax is subject to the origination clause. Well, the monies raised in Sections 5 and Section 6 of the House-originated bill went into the general treasury. And this is the joint
taxation. All right, so when you had that sentence about 200 years, we don't have anything that says that, all right? That's just an observation on your part?
No. If you go back, you know, this is a Senate's description, but in that 1872 Senate report
That's what you're relying on?
Well, it's one example, and it's repeated.
That's not 200 years. I'm just trying to find some authority for this sentence, that's all.
The House, and as best I can tell, has taken quite a broad view of what constitutes a revenue bill. I mean, the CRS report provides a series of precedents that are examples.
So I guess my question is, since the Supreme Court has strictly defined what is a revenue bill, shouldn't that be what we look at?
We're suggesting that the minimalist approach here, and the approach that doesn't walk into any disagreements between the House and the Supreme Court, is the approach that was, you know, governed by Rainey, which is, let's you know, assume, just as the district court did in the second half of its opinion, assume that the Affordable Care Act had measures that raised revenues that went into the general treasury. That is equally true of the House-originated bill.
Is that the test, in your view, of what's a revenue-raising bill, is that it has funds that go into the general treasury and eventually might raise money? I mean, I thought it was a purposive approach under the clause that asks for whether it's a bill for raising revenue and that the precedents focus on the purpose. Are you not relying on that?
Your Honor is correct. And we did brief it, and we are relying on it. It is what the Supreme Court has said. What we're also suggesting, though, is the court doesn't even have to address that question, because even assuming, as the district court did in the second half of the opinion, that it suffices that a statute has provisions that raise revenues that go into the general treasury, that was equally the case for the House-originated bill. So,
can you focus for a minute? I understand you're directing us through Rainey and saying, you know, this is, I mean, then we'd have to go to the germaneness question and the extent of, you know, how we decide that and Marshall Field. But assuming that we're on the part of your argument that asserts that the ACA is not a bill for raising revenue, can you tell us what your strongest arguments are on that?
Well, the Supreme Court, dating back to Norton, just 1875, is the earliest case in which the court, it's a statutory case, but it's explicitly invoking origination clause principles. And the court said, you know, revenue bills, essentially it's a term of art that meant bills for the direct and avowed purpose of raising revenue to support the government. And that's, you know, quoting from Justice Story. And the Supreme Court has repeated that, you know, in variants on the formulations. And yes, one example of a measure that would not be a revenue bill because it's not for the direct and avowed purpose of raising revenues to support the government's general operations would be if you have an earmarked fund. But that's
what,
not
the, yeah, what about the fact that these funds go into the Treasury generally?
Well, again, I mean, in Norton, it was also the case that the funds went to the Treasury generally. But again, I'm suggesting that this might be an area in which a court would want to say less rather than more, just because the House and the Senate have an established practice that was followed here and also 1982 and 1986. If the House originates what it regards as a revenue measure, which it takes a fairly broad view of, is it amending the income, you know, the Internal Revenue Code? Are we affecting revenues? Is it, you know, raising in the sense of does this concern the collection of monies? Then the Senate can amend it as it sees fit, just as on any other bill. So again, going back to the text, and this was deliberate. This was a deliberate departure in the origination clause from the practice of the House of Lords. The Lords did not have the power to amend money bills proposed by comments.
What about counsel's argument that we ought to look to James Madison's statement?
It's a misunderstanding of James Madison's statement. So I'll just quickly walk through the history.
Let's not walk through the history, but I just want your response to his discussion that we shouldn't look at the Philadelphia Convention.
Although the decision that controls is Rainey, if the court wants to look to comfort that Rainey was correct, the original proponent of the Origination Clause, Elbridge Gerry, had a restriction, no Senate amendments, and there was also a variant by Edmund Randolph with limited Senate amendments. That is not what the convention adopted. They adopted and they gave the Senate coextensive power to amend a House revenue bill as it has to amend all other bills. Eldridge Gerry said, wait, you've destroyed my proposal. I would not have signed on to this. And he did not, in fact, sign the Constitution, and he opposed ratification. Madison, what he actually said, and Grayson explicitly said in the Virginia debates, this will allow the state to strike everything after the whereas or introductory clause and substitute its own language. And Madison said that's of small consequence because you don't have to pass the legislation that the Senate proposes. You're still ultimately the judges of its propriety.
Do you think any of that discussion is relevant to the alternative argument you want us to adopt?
It just confirms that the Supreme Court was correct in Rainey when the Supreme Court said it is sufficient that the Senate amendment was an amendment to a House revenue bill. We don't compare beyond that. It is not for the court to compare the subject matter of the bills.
So no germaneness inquiry whatsoever?
Correct. Just as there is no germaneness inquiry imposed by the Constitution for any other type of House bill, there is no germaneness inquiry for a revenue bill. It's sufficient that the House bill was a revenue bill. And this really is the holding of Rainey. And I've read the entire analysis of the Supreme Court.
So just to be clear, let's suppose we'd like something stronger than Justice Story's commentaries on the Constitution as evidence of kind of the original intent. We'd like something from one of the founders on how to determine whether a bill is for raising revenue. Is there anything you can point to that from the founders that helps us answer that question?
Well, we have invoked Justice Story because the Supreme Court repeatedly in the early cases relied on Justice Story.
But Judge Wilson wants some other authority.
Well, we're not invoking Justice Story directly. We're invoking the Supreme Court in Norton and Twin Cities and Millard that says, they happen to be quoting Justice Story, but they're saying this was a term understood by the founders to mean a bill for the direct and avowed purpose of raising revenue. But I just want to make sure the court understands why I'm encouraging the alternative ground for decision.
It'd be helpful if you could answer Judge Wilkins' question.
I have not seen a citation in the Supreme Court cases, or to other descriptions by, other members of the founding generation of what is a bill for raising revenue. I have seen, and, we've supplied the repeated understanding that there is no constraint on the Senate's amendment power. So, again, the holding of Rainey, this is where current House and Senate practice, historical evidence, and the Supreme Court all align. And so even explicitly assuming that you would have a broader understanding of the bill for raising revenue, that you wouldn't look to the purpose, that you would just look to whether funds go to the Treasury, it doesn't matter here.
So no bill is going to violate the Origination Clause under your view?
No. So first, if you had the situation like Hubbard, that was just a Senate-originated bill. And that was actually what the Hubbard Court was saying, was essentially you did this backwards. The House.
Right, so all they have to do is wait for something revenue-raising to come from the House, eviscerate it, put the other text in, and we're done.
Well,
so it becomes a formality.
It's not a substantive constraint, but it's a real procedural tool, and the House vigorously protects its prerogative because it regards it as meaningful. I mean, the same Congress that passed the Affordable Care Act loose-lipped six other Senate measures based on the Origination Clause. So this is being able to control the timing of a revenue measure is, from a parliamentary perspective, that's very significant to the relations between the House and Senate.
So is your view Scalia's view? Is it Scalia's view and Munoz Flores?
Scalia,
formal,
yes,
very formal.
Concurs in Munoz Flores and says nothing in this area should be justiciable. Essentially, that's really the enrolled bill rule, which is once it's duly enacted and signed, courts don't engage in any inquiry. That's not the argument we're making here. We understand Munoz Flores that in the beginning it said there are justiciable inquiries. But the one thing, just as a substantive matter, the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills, and under Rainey, there is no constraint on the Senate's ability to amend the House revenue bill.
All right. Anything further?
No,
Thank you. All right. Counsel for appellant.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in NFIB said that even if the taxing power enables Congress to impose a tax on not obtaining health insurance, any tax must still comply with the requirements in the Constitution, and that, of course, includes the origination clause.
And then it went on to talk about the direct tax
measure. And
never mentioned the origination clause.
That's right. The question was never briefed by or addressed or
never
nor
raised.
Was presented by the
is that correct?
In that case. That's correct. The question was never raised. And here we have a law that is basically this is like a sin tax, right? It's like a tax on alcohol or tobacco, right? Which has, on one hand, a regulatory purpose of getting people to smoke less, but on the other hand, it has the fundraising purpose of gathering money for the general treasury and general revenue.
Although, if we were looking at purpose at the time, they were hoping it wouldn't raise any money. They were hoping that it would work as anticipated. They wouldn't be getting money from people who were non-compliant.
When people support taxes on tobacco, ideally nobody would smoke tobacco and you wouldn't raise any money through a tobacco tax. But nevertheless, it's a tax and must comply with the origination clause. And the government puts all this emphasis on, well, if the Congress can enforce this provision by itself, but that's precisely the approach that the Supreme Court rejected in Munoz-Flores. In footnote 4, it specifically rejected Justice Scalia's argument in his concurring opinion. And that means...
Well, they're not saying it's non-justiciable. They're just saying it's a pretty narrow and formal inquiry.
But a total deference test cannot be the appropriate test here. There must be some constitutional difference between originate and amend. And that the only difference... No normal speaker of English would think amend means completely replace. Amend means to add something or change something that has the same character as the original bill. Now,
as
there's no reason...
As they would on any other bill.
The reason as on any other bill was added to the Constitution was because it might imply some other kind of limit on the Senate's power.
And how
which
do we
wasn't,
know that?
I'm sorry?
How do we know that?
It's the normal reading of the Constitution, absent that phrase, would be that it would imply some other kind of limit on the Senate's power. But what we know from the Philadelphia Convention was that the exchange, and we cite this in our brief, on our opening brief on page 21.
So you want us to rely on the Philadelphia Convention?
Well, and Your Honor asked about the Philadelphia Convention. It has been routine that the ratification conventions tend to be more enlightening. Those also support our position, as the law review article which we lodged with the court demonstrates. But if you're interested in the Philadelphia Convention, at that convention, Madison opposed the origination clause because he was concerned that limiting the Senate's power in this respect would lead to difficult questions about the Senate using its amendment power to substitute completely new legislation. And it was knowing that would not be allowed, knowing that the origination clause would raise this problem with procedure, that the convention nevertheless approved the clause. So
that's one reading of the convention.
It's unclear to me how you could read the convention otherwise.
Well, you can read what other people said.
Well, that's
it was a compromise and pay back for other compromises.
And the compromise was that the Senate's power to amend whatever it might be cannot be to originate. The only thing we know for absolute certain about the origination clause is that the Senate cannot originate revenue-raising measures. And it's not necessary for the court to get into the question of how much alteration of the original is appropriate and so forth, because here we have the complete substitution of a 6-page bill that was not a bill for raising revenue with a 2,000-page bill that was a bill for raising revenue. So it's not necessary.
What about TEFRA?
I'm sorry? The TEFRA cases?
The Ninth Circuit in Armstrong.
In Armstrong, I think Armstrong supports our position by saying that germaneness is constitutionally required. Now, in that case, it was germane. There you had a general revenue bill, and it was replaced by another general revenue bill. Here you have a bill that was not a general revenue bill, and so the TEFRA cases are not directly applicable. But on the question of germaneness, the TEFRA cases that reach the merits are completely on our side about germaneness. And it's common sense that germaneness must be inherent to the word amend. Something that is not germane is simply not an amendment. Otherwise, the origination clause would turn into a shell game. It would be easy for the Senate to sit back and wait for anything, even something like a targeted tax credit that's not a bill for raising revenue, but maybe they could argue that it had something to do with taxes.
So you want the courts under the origination bill to instruct the legislative body as to when a bill is germane?
That is precisely what is not necessary in this case, Your Honor, because here you have a bill that was completely replaced with a completely different bill. If this court did think that it was necessary to get into what germaneness means in more detail, there are cases that used...
If we adopted your first sentence, isn't that an instruction to the House and the Senate?
I think Munoz-Flores is the instruction to the House and the Senate, and that instruction is that the Senate does not have the power to originate bills for raising revenue.
Anything further?
I did want to say that Texas Office of Public Utilities versus FCC in the Fifth Circuit supports our reading of Munoz-Flores. I believe you asked if Munoz-Flores was the only case that stood for that proposition, and it is not.
All right. Is that cited in your brief?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. All right. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.